Good morning, afternoon, evening, whenever you're listening to this, to Vikings Territory Breakdown. I'm your congenial host, Joe Oberle, and here with my producer, Mike Waldeman, in the background, and he's pushing all the buttons to get this out to you. and we're with our other co-host, as always, Mark Craig, esteemed NFL writer for the Star Tribune newspaper and StarTribune.com. For many years, holds the only NFL Hall of Fame vote in town, so we're happy he's here talking to us. And he's also the back page writer for Minnesota Golfer Magazine, which I should mention, and for you know, self-serving reasons, of course, but and an author of a book. But I've written three books, so I beat him there, but his is about Vikings, so you guys don't care about mine. So anyway, Mark, welcome. How you doing, brother?
Geez, Joe, it takes on the first tee, it takes less time to introduce Tiger Woods than you introducing me.
Yes, I'm feeling like Phil Mickelson over here, you know, and the famous scene when they're going through Tiger's list of victories and he's teeing off with Phil, and Phil's over there. All right, all right. It's one of my favorite all-time
games in golf.
There's that rivalry. But yeah, it's like that's like you and me. Next time I think we'll
have
do that on the first tee. But, you know, what a difference a week makes in the world of Minnesota Vikings. You know, week one.
You doubted them. Yeah, you doubted them. I told you.
I knew as, you know, 10 seconds in, I thought I'd hear about that. Thanks, Mark. But week one, we thought the season was over, you know, had no thoughts that they might even go out and win in Arizona. They should have won week one. They should have won in Arizona. So then we really thought the season was over. At least I did, apparently. And, you know, they come in, you know, Mark said, no, they're going to win. And they turned it around. What did you see that going into the game that that buoyed your support of the purple against the Seattle Seahawks?
First of all, they were home, and it was going to be a stadium that hadn't had fans in it since 2019. I thought that would make a huge difference, and it did. And also, I love the way the offensive line played against Arizona. I love the way Kirk Cousins played because of the offensive line. I never really thought the entire week, because I made the pick, you know, on Tuesday. Now, when Dalvin was listed as out, he didn't practice on Friday. But he didn't practice on Friday. I was thinking he would not play because when a guy doesn't do anything on Fridays, typically they don't play. Now, it makes you a little nervous, but I still thought that the way they played in Arizona, that they would beat Seattle at home. Now, if it had been out in Seattle, I would have picked Seattle.
A longtime writer and observer, you know, tries not to be swayed by sentiment that goes flowing through the Purple Nation biosphere, I guess. Instead, you're looking for maybe trends that you see are sustainable. And we saw an improved offensive line each week, didn't we? In those first two games, and that gave them hope, maybe against.
Well, it wasn't slow improvement. It was horrible against Cincinnati. The six holding penalties, five of which I think were accepted. The false starts, they weren't all on the offensive line, but they played high. They played tentative. They got run over, and a lot of that had to do with down and distance. But they came out against Arizona and was a different offensive line, I thought, and then I thought they were even better against Seattle. Now they got a big one against the Browns because they got a better defensive line, I feel. But yeah, this is what they can do when they can control the situation with what any team can do when you can control the game with an offensive line.
Since we're talking offensive line, why is this happening? What was the change? I mean, was the first game just a new unit together, not sure of themselves, not ready, not whatever? But now we're possibly seeing the offensive line that we're going to go forward with. I mean, they don't have either one of the rookies they drafted in there. They've got some of these not cast-offs, but guys they drafted in the later rounds, you know, Udo and Rashad Hill, that are all of a sudden looking, you know, maybe like they were the person the Vikings were thinking about when they picked them up. Why do you think that there are changes going on there?
Well, I mean, Rashad Hill's a guy they picked up off the Jacksonville practice squad at the end of a season probably 5 years ago now. He's a swing tackle. I mean, let's just like we didn't throw him in the garbage in week one or two when they lost, let's not put him in the Hall of Fame in week three.
Oh, come on.
They're playing very well together. I think Udo is And yeah, that first game, I mean, you look at how the NFL offseason and preseason goes now. They held Udo was a guy who had seven games in his career, never started a game. They held him out with all the starters in that first preseason game. That's, you know, I guess that's what they have to do now, but that's getting guys ready for the season anymore. You're just kind of like, let's just stay healthy, and then we'll start getting into game shape once the season starts. That's totally different than how things used to be. So, yeah, the offensive line hadn't really played together in the preseason very much. So, yeah, we're seeing what they can do. Now, you know, we'll be sitting here next week. If Myles Garrett has four and a half sacks again, we'll be saying, oh, Rashad Hill, we got to get him out of there. It's a week-to-week thing. It's just matchups mean a lot. Against Arizona, I thought that they changed the game plan a lot to help Rashad Hill. You know, like they should have done in Cincinnati, more tight ends, more receivers chipping them, running backs helping, you know, going quicker to the other side, throwing it over his head, Chandler Jones. So the game plan got better in week two as well. And then I think that they got rolling in toward the middle part of the second quarter against Seattle. And then just, you know, they were dominating in that fourth quarter with those long runs from Madison.
So you said the game plan changed, obviously. So that's, you know, that you would think on the surface level, the Vikings are going to want to continue to do that, you know, especially with Cleveland coming to town. But Cleveland's going to assume that, and they're going to try to counteract that. What do you do? Do the Vikings have to tweak again just to, you know, in anticipation of that potentiality? What do you think?
Well, I think they got to treat Myles Garrett like they did Chandler Jones. You know, a lot of it's, you know, this game is, it is a complicated game, but sometimes you overcomplicate it. I mean, I think the difference in the way the offensive line played against Cincinnati, there was a lot, physically they were different. They just played lower. They played faster. They were, you know, things just, it seemed almost seemed like they were pissed off that they played the way they did and, you know, taking the heat that they're taking. And they just stepped it up. And I think that it has a big part of it, as well as, you know, there was some changes made, but you know, a lot of this game is just emotion and how you play, not making mistakes. I mean, since they had 12 penalties in that first game, they've only, and in two games since then, they've only had seven penalties, I believe. And one of those penalties was taking a delay of game at the end of this game so that they could, you know, punt the ball away when they've already won. So really only six penalties.
The penalties themselves is an amazing transition. I got to tell you, just looking at you on the screen here, I watched the movie Citizen Kane last night. And I don't know if you know, if you're familiar with it, but it's got all these ceiling shots. And that's, I see a lot of your ceiling there. I'm not saying you're Orson Welles or look like him, I'm just trying to bring some class to this podcast. And you are already doing it. I mean, we're at Citizen Kane level. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. I got nothing for you, Joe.
That's all right. That's all right.
My mind. I went right to Orson Welles, so yeah. So. Salted. Where's
the Alfred? I could have called the Alfred Hitchcock, but I didn't do that. Let's see. Let's get into what went right. Pretty much everything for a while, but there's some problems early. Russell Wilson was dealing in that first half, and you know, they got over like 300 yards in offense going, you know, he was really picking on Breland with DK Metcalf. And, you know, in fact, at one point after they scored, when Metcalf was playing way off, and he said, don't see a corner backpedal in the end zone from the 10-yard line very often. Way too soft coverage from Breland there. Got to do better or try something else. Well, you know, is that Breland, you know, afraid and doing his own thing? Or is that they say, hey, play off him? Why'd that happen? And what was going on there, Mark?
Well, I think that's Breland being so afraid of the – because, you know, DK Metcalf is, you know, he's tight end sized. Yeah. I think that's being afraid of the fade and not realizing that when he's backpedaling, but when Wilson completes that pass, I think Breland is in the end zone. So it was a ridiculous way to play that. And, you know, it's an easy pitch and catch touchdown. Metcalf's an earlier long catch that he had, he totally faked out. It was one of the first times we saw Peterson not, you know, do what he's supposed to, other than the touchdown in Arizona. But he got faked out to the outside, and then Metcalf ran a great route to the inside and had a big gain. Yeah, Metcalf had, what, 5 catches for 88 yards and a touchdown in the first 16 minutes of that game. After that, he had 1 catch for 19 yards.
That's an adjustment made, huh? Yeah.
It's an adjustment, but it's also the offense. I mean, people say, you know, well, hey, why did they play – what did the defense do differently in the second half? Well, yeah, they played well. Everson Griffin had that sack at a key moment. He had pressure in the play before that. And they went. Seattle went 0-for-3 in the second half on third down. But also, they only had the ball for 7 minutes. The offense held the ball for 23 minutes in the second half. So, and they score. And give the kicker credit. Whenever they didn't score a touchdown, he banged it through a week after, you know, that low moment for him. So, it's all complimentary stuff. And it this is what you can be whenever your offensive line's playing well, your defensive line is playing well, your kicker's making the kick. And your quarterback is playing lights out,
which is the dream scenario for Zimmer. That's what he imagined it in his offense, isn't it? To, you know, ball control, keep the other team off the field, let your defense, you know, handle a lot, keep them rested. That's kind of what he's been looking for since he's been here, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think he's even surprised about, especially, you know, your best player offensively is not on the field. I'm sure there's some nerves there about that. And to do this, I mean, imagine that Dalvin Cook's their best offensive player. You know, no offense to Kirk Cousins, but Dalvin Cook is their all-pro guy. And Zimmer gets to the end of the game and says, this is the best offense I've seen in 8 years. That doesn't mean that Dalvin Cook shouldn't play. It means this is what you can do if you're playing well on the offensive line, your quarterback's playing well, your quarterback's playing fast, physically, mentally. I mean, he's seeing things. He's reacting. But a lot of that is because he doesn't have people in his face. So this is what you can do when you can control the line of scrimmage.
You know, Wilson was dealing early, and the Vikings, after that first drive, which was a great drive, they stopped answering the scores, and it looked like a foot race, and you need both shoes for a foot race. But Kirk at one point didn't have his, and I was already writing a headline, Vikings get knocked out of their shoes. So I was already out. But they righted the ship, and you know, we always hear about adjustments, and they talk about halftime adjustments. Sometimes we see them materialize in the field, and other times they don't. This was dramatic. Can you pinpoint, or has Zimmer elaborated in any way on and what they did differently? Did he just chew their ass out? Did he just tell them to stop freelancing? What went on, you know, for the Vikings to have such a dramatic shift from the first half to the second half in that on their defense?
Yeah, I think one, like I said, one was they were only on the field for about seven and a half minutes or whatever it was. The other thing, you know, Zimmer did mention was that some of the guys were freelancing. I think one of the things he's referring to, I don't know if you remember before that 30-yard touchdown run by Seattle. I mean, Russell Wilson saw something immediately, and there was kind of a hole on that left side of the offensive line. Maybe Kendricks is playing a little too inside. I don't know. But there's this gap, and he makes all these motions, and he calls that play, checks out of whatever he's going to run. And Carson hits a 30-yard touchdown that was easy. Well, on that play, Kendricks fills the wrong gap. I mean, that gap's already taken care of. My assumption is that he's supposed to play the next gap and fell for a move or something that Carson kind of hipped and went to the outside to the next hole, which should have been Kendricks. Well, he got caught in traffic inside, and that's a 30-yard touchdown. Well, that's something that when this team starts to fall apart, it's always the run defense where the first crack happens. And that, you know, at that point, I don't know what it is, the score, but it could be getting away from them. Now, a huge play in that game was it's 17-7. Seattle gets a 3-and-out with a sack. And then, but they have a holding penalty, which gives the Vikings a first down. The Vikings go 73 yards for a touchdown on a, you know, just start chewing up the field. And that game became a completely different game.
You're exactly right. And for me, one of the things I saw was that the pressure on Wilson really increased. I mean, to see him, and it was probably more later in the game, but to see him just kind of lost back there because he I think they got to him enough times where he was sensing the rush and he wasn't as just, you know, Aaron Rodgers like sitting back there picking his spots. He was kind of looking around and concerned and throwing desperation passes. It's like, my goodness, what a difference frontline pressure makes. And maybe this defensive line is really starting to come into its own a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, there was one thing I was watching for the, you know, for the Star Tribune, for the things I do, the five extra points the next day. One was him outside the pocket. The contrast between what they had to deal with in Arizona, a 24-year-old Kyler Murray compared to a 32-year-old. This is the difference in 11 NFL seasons. We saw it because 32 years old, when he only left the pocket, I think, seven times. And the only time he really hurt him was on the very first play of the game. They did a bootleg, and they hit a 24-yard pass to Metcalf. After that, he left, I think, for passes 0-for-3, I think, 0-for-4, got outside the pocket and just threw it away. He had no one to throw to, just threw it away. So that means the Vikings downfield aren't worried about him taking off and running. They're staying on their receivers. So there's nothing for him to do. And the defensive line can chase him down. Kyler Murray, you couldn't do that. He'd be gone. And then he ran three times and, you know, just out of desperation and gained like 2 yards, 1 yard, and 4 yards. So he was a non-factor outside the pocket. And, you know, that's credit, because as we've seen over the years, this guy was 7-0 against the Vikings. He could pretty much toy with them when he needed to win a game. And he couldn't do that this time.
Yeah, he got outrushed by someone across the line. I got to talk about the elephant in the room. It was always the elephant in the room on this podcast when I was with my friend and co-podcaster Joe Johnson, who loved Kirk Cousins. And it just breaks my heart that he's not around to see this performance from Kirk's first three games. I mean, we went from the season being over after week one to season after game three, they're talking about Kirk as an MVP. I think it's a little bit premature. But
well, when you're one, yeah. When you're 1-2, you can't be MVP, Ken.
No, you can't. I think Joe would still be leading that bandwagon, though. Anyway, Cousins had a great first half, 16 to this is in the first half, 16 to 20, 185, three TDs and no picks for a 144.8 rating. My goodness. I mean, most players would kill for that in a game, you know, and he got that in the first half and really kept him in it till the defense turned it around. What's the anti-Kirk crowd going to do with this, Mark? He's playing really well right now, and he had a great flipping game on Sunday.
Well, my guess, if I had to guess what the anti-Kirk crowd will go for is I've been accused of being in that, and then whenever he plays well and you praise him like we've been praising him for 2 weeks, then you get accused of being the Kirk apologist or whatever. I would imagine that they'll go for the, this sets up the COVID meltdown where he's not vaccinated. But, you know, to me, he has played well, even in Cincinnati. I mean, there was one time where he held the ball and got sacked near his own goal line. A lot of that was just, you got to look at Kirk, who he is, and he needs protection like he's had the last 2 weeks. If he doesn't get it, he's not going to create things. He's not going to be Kyler Murray, even though he outrushed Kyler Murray. So, what he's done is at the end of halves and at the end of games has put them in position to, you know, the first week, Greg Joseph kicks the 53-yarder because Kirk moves him down the field, moved him down the field to try and win the game in overtime, and Dalvin fumbles. So he's done that 3 weeks now where, you know, this time last year we were seeing kind of, I think the Titans game, some other games where, okay, here's Kirk, here's what you're getting paid for. And then you'd have like a 30-second three and out where you're like, that's it, that's all he's got. And now we're seeing Kirk, really move this team in the 2-minute drill. And it's been fun to watch.
That absolutely has been. I mean, I'm just wondering why one of the few passes he didn't complete was the throwing of his shoe behind him. But, what's changed? I mean, I think this is what the anti-Kirk crowd has always, you know, craved for, someone that's going to take charge at the end of these halves and really lead the team down. Kirk will do it, has done it occasionally, but I don't think he's done it consistently. I mean, we saw on Monday night when flipping Aaron Rodgers, who was 37 seconds, moves his team into field goal range and wins a game.
The whole world knew that was going to happen.
Exactly. Yeah. That's my point. And with Kirk, it's just the opposite because, you know, he hasn't done it consistently enough. I didn't have, you know, maybe the confidence is building there around Kirk, but, you know, it doesn't have it. My knock on him has always been, and I think he's a decent quarterback, but he's not going to take the Vikings to the promised land because he doesn't have that it or whatever it is that you need at the end of halves or the end of games to win. And it seems like he's starting to show it. Is it because he got so railed on for his anti-vax stance, or is it something else? I mean, what's going on? I mean, Judd Zolgad talked, I saw I tweeted something on a friend of both of ours and a former colleague of yours, said that his willingness to get rid of the ball quickly this season is making a huge difference. Do you see that out there? Is that part of what's going on with Kirk?
Well, what's going on with Kirk is that the offensive line's protecting him. I mean, just watch the game and just watch where the pocket right in front of him, whenever he's making these throws, I mean, his accuracy is what you pay him for. His decision-making is what you pay him for. But when he can't, doesn't have the time to do that, then he's basically of little use to you because he's not going to scramble on a consistent basis. He's not going to scramble around and find a guy off kilter or whatever, you know, he's just off script or whatever, however you want to phrase it. He's not going to do that. But whenever he's looking around and he can step up and Bradbury's not sitting in his lap or, you know, the guard isn't holding someone and he fires it, he's going to find the open guy and it's going to work.
You know, you brought up Cook not being there and Alexander Mattison having a great game, a career game in some aspects. He rushed 26 times for 112 yards and he had six catches for 59 yards receiving. And, you know, granted, he hasn't had the opportunity, but given the opportunity, he showed he did really well. How much of it is the improved offensive line? How much of it is perhaps he doesn't get the attention that Cook does when he's in the game? How much of it is anything else? And what will the Vikings do going forward, knowing that they have this kind of offense with Mattison in there? I mean, do they start, you know, giving Cook even less opportunities and to keep him healthy and put Mattison in there a little bit more than they even already do? I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think it's, Cook is a great back and Mattison is a really, really good back, a good backup. I think what it is offensive line. I mean, it's the offensive line where they're playing. Mattison can do these things. And whereas Cook's yardage can be explosive, you know, big chunks, and he can make certain moves that where he can go all the way. Whereas Mattison was more of a, I don't want to say plotting because he's better than a plotter. But, you know, they just wore down Seattle. And in that fourth quarter, it's 1st and 10, and everyone knows they're going to run the ball. And he gets 24 yards because the offensive line and he are in such a groove and they're just overpowering Seattle. So, yeah, it's an offensive line. He probably doesn't get as much attention as because a Cook would because the great players get the attention. And he's, you know, in situations like this, he's good. He's great to have. You wouldn't want him to play an entire season as your starter because Cook is so good. They're going to need that. Like Cleveland. Cleveland is a more talented team. They're going to need Dalvin Cook if they want to beat Cleveland.
A couple quick hitters for you. Everson Griffin with the sack, but was right after he had a really dumb roughing the passer penalty. We've kind of seen those things before from him, but it was still nice to see Griff making some moves, doing a spin move and getting in the backfield and wreaking some havoc. That really bodes well for the defensive line going forward, eh?
Yeah, I think his roughing came later, I'm pretty sure. I think it was later, but, you know, I didn't like that penalty. It gave him a little nudge, and I think Wilson flopped a little bit. I'm having a problem with, you know, I guess old school. I don't want to see a guy come breaking through and go helmet to helmet with a quarterback or throw him over his back like Joe Turkey Jones of the Browns in the 70s against the Steelers. But, you know, some of this stuff is just out of control. It's, you know, there was one, yeah. I mean, it was a kind of college game where a guy comes through the middle and tackles around the waist, and they said it was too low, and they, you know, penalty. So I thought Griffin played really well, but on that sack, you know, if you go back and watch it, I wish I had gone back, and because I wrote about it in Monday's paper. I would like to have watched it again, which I could have found it somewhere, but just to what was going on around him. I mean, on the outside, Tomlinson had pressure. Daniil had pressure on the other side. So it's like if Griffin didn't get him, one of those other four were going to get him. It was because the rush was so intense. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, I'm not saying they're totally different at home, but because they're good anywhere. Daniil Hunter is good at every place. Everson, when he's in shape and football ready, is going to be good anywhere. But when they're at home with that crowd, I mean, they could be lights out. And that's one thing they need to really take advantage of this week.
Maybe that nudge is, or taking that penalty is good for the defense in its accumulative effect. I talked earlier about how even Russell Wilson got a little gun shy later. And so maybe that's stuff that you want to do just to make that. And there was a time early in the game when Cousins got shoved down too. No call, of course, but it was after he'd gotten the ball out. But
yeah. I mean, they're the three penalties that, you know, like I said, they had the one at the end for the delay of game, which was nothing. But three that they had, you know, Bradbury has a holding penalty in the red zone. Normally that will cause you to either settle for a field goal or blow it. They come back with the touchdown to Thielen, third and 13. There was a illegal block on a punt return that put them – they would have had the ball like at the 40. It put them back at like the 15. They went down and still kicked a field goal. And then Griffin's penalty, they still – that was that drive ended with the 4th and 12, the incompletion in the end zone, the deep ball. So none of their penalties hurt them. They only had three of them, but none of them hurt them.
Greg Joseph is off the hot seat for a week anyway. I guess he was perfect on six kicks, three field goals, and which was all the score in the second half. It was great that he came through. But then this came on a day when a rare occurrence, an opposing kicker missed a kick against the Vikings, and Justin Tucker hit a 66-yard field goal to set the NFL record against the Port Lions. And I wrote to you, I said, for crying out loud, isn't Tucker 66 years old, for crying out loud? He's been in the league. But what a day for kickers, at least a couple of them anyway. So that's nice for Joseph. And as far as Zimmer's concerned, I suspect that's just what he's supposed to do. And everything else that doesn't rise to that is a demerit. But for one day, he's singing his praises a little bit.
And the other thing he did was, because this guy could have a touchback anytime he wants. They could never have to cover a kick again the way he kicks off. But what he also did was they started like wanting to put it high enough to where they could pin the Seahawks inside the 25. And I don't have the numbers in front of me, but he did that a couple times where he kicked it right to the goal line and they're forced to return it. And the Vikings, who were terrible in coverage that last year, tackles the guy inside the 25. So that's, you know, that's another thing that goes unnoticed, I think, with kickers.
The receiving was great. When you got a great quarterback performance, you better have some receivers. 77 receptions, 70 yards, and a touchdown for Tyler Conklin. Is that his name? His first name's Tyler, isn't it? Justin Jefferson, 9, 118 for a score. And his first big game this year, and Thielen, Mr. Reliable, 6 for 50 and a score. Was this more a product of great play by the Vikings or a poor secondary for the Seahawks, do you think?
I mean, we'll see. I mean, the secondary had to cover, you know, because of the protection, they had to cover longer. KJ Osborne had some catches too, some key catches, and Kirk got crushed on that one, I think, third down play where he gets it out to, I think it was KJ. So, you know, Kirk also did some things when he was getting hit. This is what you can do. This is what Kirk Cousins can do, spreading it around whenever he has time. But, yeah, I mean, there were a lot of – I mean, it'll be interesting going forward because you go back and watch that game, there's a lot of receivers that were wide open just with huge, you know, tracts of land around them. So – it's definitely not the Legion of Boom that we're used to with Seattle. But we'll see going forward. If Kirk gets that time, he's still going to complete a lot of those tighter throws.
He did hang in there for and take some shots. One of them famously on that play you mentioned. And he's done that in the past sporadically. He's not going to do that like Favre in the NFC Championship game in 2009 and just get beat the hell up and take a licking and keep on ticking. But is this Mad Kirk all of a sudden frustrated with the two losses and knowing that his reputation's online is coming out and giving his all? Because I see him as more of a protective, happy feet quarterback more often than I see him standing in, seeing that rush coming and taking the shot. I don't want him to take the shots. I want him to be protected because I don't like our backup situation yet. But I'd like to see more of this from Kirk where he's just, you know, landed on the line to get that pass completed.
Well, yeah, I think that you could do that when it's occasionally, you know, when it's every third down and you got someone in, you got two guys in your face and the pocket's closed in on you, you know, you're not going to do that. But, you know, that was a rare occasion in that game where he had a quick pressure right at him. And, you know, to do that's great. But consistently, he's not going to be a guy that's going to function he's a pocket passer. He can get out and move, but he's basically a pocket passer. And those are just not too many of them in the league.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's now we're going to talk about what went wrong. Not much. So maybe this is the time to take a break, huh? We will be back with the next segment of Vikings Territory Breakdown. We're going to talk about what's coming next week, those big bad Browns that Mark knows so well. And we'll talk about that then, and see you after the break. All right, welcome back to Vikings Territory Breakdown with myself and Mark Craig from the Star Tribune. Before we get into the Browns, let's talk about that pick from last week. You picked the Vikings, even with Dalvin out. Pretty gutsy, but I picked Seattle for the reverse jinx. And I know mine was a cumulative. I rarely pick against the Vikings. And as a result, I've had a pretty good record over time because the Vikings, you know, are one of the top five teams since they've been in the league for record. You know, they don't have the Super Bowl championships, but they've had decent teams, which is why they don't get those big quarterbacks out of the draft. They don't ever suck so bad that they get a pick in the top three. But so my record has been pretty good. However, I picked against them, and I'm going to go with reverse jinx. I saw you talking with
somebody. Reverse jinx. You thought they were going to lose. Come on. Reverse jinx.
I did. I didn't feel good about it at all. Not with the record against Seattle and not with the way they had played. I didn't know who the real Vikings were yet, but you obviously.
I never once that week, like I said, until maybe when Dalvin did on Sunday for kickoff, when Dalvin was officially out. But I just never got the feeling the Vikings were going to lose that game. I just felt coming home was going to be a big – in the way they had played against Arizona.
So do we look at the first two games differently now? I mean, that's this league, you know. Week to week, you have all this time to think about what happened and what's going to happen. The first 2 weeks were a disaster. They should have won by that first game. Going in, they didn't. They could have won it, but they fumbled at the end. And then you lose the second one by a missed field goal, which should have told you they're still a pretty good team because they played a really good team at home and had the game in hand. Do we think they're a better team now than most of us were thinking? I mean, there's people saying they should tank after the first two losses. I mean, you know, I know it's silly and that's overreaction, what have you.
But you think?
what do we think of them now, Mark? Are we starting to see the team that certainly Zim envisioned when he rebuilt the defense and has the weapons that he's got on offense? I mean, because he talked about it. He was saying early on, and a lot of the players had come out and say, yeah, we've got a pretty good team this year, you know. And you know, some people say that no matter what they got, but, you know, it sounded like some of them were feeling it this year.
Well, I would say the first week was a disaster. When you have a false start before your season starts, officially starts, that's a, you know, that's the sign of a disastrous afternoon. You know, the penalties, their only turnover came in that first, first game. You know, week two to me was not a disaster. I know we talked about it last week, but you know, Kyler Murray and that offense, there's a lot of weapons there. And I know that he had 400 yards, but I think overall the Vikings played him pretty well. And, you know, there were obviously some breakdowns, big time breakdowns, but I don't put week two on the road against that team in the disaster mode. I put the first week, it's probably too bad they couldn't play this, you know, the Bengals a little bit later. I think the Bengals being home and teams not using the off season to get ready for week one anymore, other than just stay healthy. That hurt them. They just weren't ready to play in that game. And being on the road, first time in front of fans in a while. So they should have won that game because they're better than Cincinnati. I don't know that they're better than Arizona. So they played Arizona at home and played well at their place. So, and then I put this game in a category of, yeah, this is what Zimmer envisions whenever you have an entirely new defensive line. And Everson Griffin coming back as a situational rusher. Sheldon Richardson being a backup. I mean, he's a starting caliber player. He's a situational pass rusher inside. And so is Everson, can rush inside or outside. So this is what Zim envisions whenever you have a pass rush and you have crowd, you know, fans in the stands, and your offense plays the way that it can play when the offensive line plays well.
One thing we didn't mention about the defense, what about the secondary? Are some alert to go on there? I know they shut down DK Metcalf in the second half because they started playing better. Should we be concerned going forward? Because, you know, there's going to be more good quarterbacks coming in and what have you. Is the Breland Dantzler situation, should something happen there? What are your thoughts on the Vikings secondary as a whole?
Well, I don't think Dantzler did himself any favors by tweeting after the game that I've shut my mouth long enough or whatever. You know, come on, guy. I mean, how stupid can you be? I mean, you're probably on the verge if you keep your mouth shut and you head down and be a pro, you can probably overtake Breland or at least get an opportunity to. Now, I don't know if he does get that opportunity because of the way he acted. You know, Breland, I'd still be concerned about Breland. I don't understand some of the times where he leaves the cushions that he leaves. If he's not able to cover a guy without that kind of cushion, then he's got to be replaced. Woods missed a big tackle on that long thing across the middle after the guy faked out Peterson, and Metcalf faked out Peterson, and Woods is there in position to make a tackle and he misses. I wouldn't be like an alarmed by the secondary other than maybe Breland, but they got a lot more to show us, and they didn't play at all together in the preseason. So they're kind of feeling their way as they go along too, but I'd be interested to see if Dantzler gets an opportunity, if Zimmer reaches a point where he feels he might start playing him more rather than just an injury situation.
I heard Barr has been starting to get on the field. 2-point question: Are we okay without him? Nick Vigil's doing pretty well so far, and will that allow them to be more cautious with Barr? And the other part of it is, you think we'll see him this week, and will that help coverage getting Barr out there, a healthy Barr anyway?
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to see Barr in there just to see, you know, to compare where, because we haven't seen him in 19 games or whatever it is. You know, and he's got that knee problem that bothers him. And, you know, Vigil has played really well. Let's see. Let's see. You know, Barr's physically a more gifted player. But let's see. And he's obviously, although Vigil knows the defense too, but Barr knows it better than anyone on that field other than maybe Kendricks. Mm-hmm. So I'd be interested to see him. But, you know, they're not. What's good is that they went out and got Vigil, who knows the defense, who's a much better player than I think any of us gave him credit for. Now, when Barr comes back, yeah, the three of them will play in the base, but you probably don't see the base defense a whole lot. So that would really take time away from Vigil. Let's see if Barr can earn it. If Barr comes in and doesn't earn it, then put Vigil back in. Don't look at the contracts. Put Vigil in and ride him.
All right. Well, that's all good points. I'd like to see it as well. But it's time to go to the Mark's favorite segment of this entire year, talking about the Cleveland Browns. I'm going to tee up a little bit here. I mean, there's a lot of storylines. Stefanski coming home, and he's probably feeling pretty good after dismantling. I mean, he's at 2-1, and he's just dismantled the Bears. I mean, that was what they did to Justin Fields was quite amazing. OBJ is back, and they got the two-headed monster in the backfield. Both of them looked really strong. I mean, Kareem Hunt and Nick Chubb. I mean, there's you know, pick your poison on that one, because they both seem to be running real well. Probably has a lot to do with their offensive line. On the other side of the ball, we got old Myles Garrett, who's going to be looking to do a repeat last week. We had 4 sacks last week. Is that right?
Yeah. 4.5 sacks last week. And also Clowney on the other side had 2 sacks. So, yeah, they had 9 sacks. Justin Fields, for one who wanted Justin Fields, you got him. I think he's going to be a good player. But if you're going to play him, first of all, don't treat him like he's Andy Dalton. Don't put him in the same offense. Do something to take advantage of who he is. An inexperienced rookie that can run and hurt you that way. He can't play like Andy Dalton in the pocket. He had 67 or 68 yards passing and 67 yards in sacks. So they had a net 1 yard pass. Now, obviously, they are not going to do that to the Vikings in Minnesota. But you know, this is going to be a much tougher test for that offensive line than what they got on against Seattle.
How is it fun for you to see that coming from the Browns and see where they're kind of ascending here? I mean, it's been, you know, they've been building for a while, and then Stefanski comes in and they got a coach that really knows what he's doing, I think, and which many people in this town would like to see coaching the Vikings. But you know, I know you're a longtime fan, and certainly your brother was a longtime fan of suffering with some of the Browns. I got to admit that, you know, just because of the Vikings wall, that before this game on Sunday, I played the Factory of Sadness for many of my relatives, just saying, this is what the Vikings are right now. But, what are your thoughts? How's it for you, you know, to watch this team just getting better and better?
Well, I know what Stefanski didn't get the job that Freddie Kitchens got. He went there and interviewed and didn't get the job. And I was joking with him. I said, you don't want that job. It's a resume killer for a young guy, you know. And then he got the job. I was like, hey, go get him, you know. But Kevin is has a special way about him that I think endears himself to old school guys, new school guys, today's players, former players. Just I always say that he knows he has 2 ears and 1 mouth, and he listens twice as much as he, you know, talks. And he just has a patient way about him that I think players really play hard for him. And he's very organized, and he has a very great way of communicating that organization. Now, to come in there into Cleveland after what Freddie did the year before with all his expectations, and take that talent and put together what they did last year with 11 wins. It was one of the easiest. I have the vote for all pro coach of the year and all that stuff. It's one of the easiest votes I've ever cast. Was you look at a team that a franchise that was a disaster, a laughingstock for over 20 years, trying to find some kind of footing in this league, in the hardest division in football. And then he comes in and does that in his first year with COVID, with not even really seeing his team in person until training camp. One of the best coaching jobs that you'll ever see.
Yeah, that's hard to deny that. So he's got that team and they're believing in him. What any other keys to this game stick out for you that you see coming forward?
Well, I think the offensive line, Cleveland talked about improving the offensive line and then did it in a year or two. The two running backs, I mean, either one can hurt you, and they both have they're both starting backs. I mean, they're both legitimate number one backs. They combined like 32 carries for 165 yards and a touchdown. Now you have Beckham back, and he hasn't created any problems off the field yet, or just not being happy or being unhappy or whatever. He looked good on, I think he had 5 catches for 77 yards, but you can just tell he's a threat that teams are going to be looking at. When you're looking at him, here come the two running backs behind a really good offensive line. Baker Mayfield is very accurate. The defense, that offense, Vikings offensive line is going to have their hands full with that front line. What helps the Vikings is being at home. Being at home with that third down, if Baker Mayfield is in 3rd and 8 and that crowd gets going and there's no, they don't jump off sides, they don't rough the passer, they don't hold, they don't pass interference. The fans and the defense can work together to beat them.
What about this coaching matchup? Kevin Stefanski was the offensive coordinator for here 1 year, and prior to that, he had got a history with this team, 14 years. And so Mike Zimmer knows him, and they know each other's tendencies a little bit. You got an offensive guy going against a defensive coach. So what do you think about that matchup? Who has the advantage in that familiarity with each other over those years?
Probably offsets each other. It's fun because Stefanski, as all offensive coordinators under a defensive coach, especially a guy like Zimmer, probably wasn't running everything he wanted to run because he had to go through Zimmer. Now, Kevin can be – I mean, one thing I really like about Kevin is he came up the old way. I mean, he learned under so many guys. He's still young, but he learned under so many different offenses. I mean, offenses that are completely different and do different things. Norv Turner's offense goes back to the Ernie Zampezi style. He learned under Chile with the West Coast and Kubiak with his style. Shermer. So he's kind of had all this put together in it. And you look at Cleveland and you see so many different ways. Now, one reason they're able to do that is because they got a really good offensive line. They got a quarterback that's, progressing and obviously no one's probably more, the guy doesn't lack confidence. Let's put it that way. And they got receivers. Now Landry, I don't think he'll play, but Beckham and they got some tight ends. So it's going to be, Zim's going to have his hands full, but I think where the advantage lies in that matchup you talk about is Zim has the crowd, which really can't emphasize enough what that does to a team coming in here.
It's going to be a heck of a matchup either way between these two teams. You got Cleveland, like I said, they're 2-1, and the Vikings coming off, a win. I mean, they played a decent game in Arizona, and they played a great game this past weekend. So they in a way they're trending, but I think just there's an emotional component to this, and there's always that letdown after a big win. So you have to fear that. Now, granted, they are at home, they will be pumped up, and you have to play week to week in this league. You can't let those highs and lows knock you off the rails. But as a Purple fan from my formative days, I'm going to go with the anti-jinx and pick Cleveland this week just to rile them up, and because I know they listen to this broadcast every week and and so Mark, nobody really gives a crap about what I think. They want to know who you're picking in this matchup between a team you've covered for 19 or for how many years, decades, and a team you grew up watching. What are you going to do, big guy, huh?
At least you're calling your anti-jinx this time. Yeah.
Yes, I am.
Yeah. I like Cleveland. It makes me – I hesitate because where it's here. But I think the Browns are – the more talented team overall. The Vikings are, it's such a close matchup and I should be taking the home team, but kind of the ebb and flow of an NFL season. Granted the Browns had the Browns had a layup last week. I mean, they got Justin Fields. Bears had no chance of winning that game in Cleveland. Now they come and they're playing a much better team on the road. I like the Browns, but I like it in a close game, and I would not be shocked if the Vikings do what we all kind of said they needed to do, be 2-2 after four games. They'll just do it the complete, probably the opposite. They're going to do it. If they get the 2-2, let's put it this way, it will be the opposite of how all of us, you know, geniuses said they needed to do it. Oh, you need to go beat Cincinnati. You need to beat Arizona. And then, well, you might lose. You'll lose to Seattle. You lose to Cleveland. Well, they're going to do it the opposite way if they beat Cleveland.
Oh, man, it's going to be a good game. I can't wait. So with that, we'll end the segment and be back after these ads for a final segment of the NFL Insider and talk about what's gone on in the NFL this past week. And join us for that. Welcome back to Vikings Territory Breakdown. Myself, Joe O'Reilly, with my cohort, Orson Welles. Mark Craig from the Star Tribune. Mark, just run down a few things that happened in the NFL this week. There was a big game on Sunday. The Packers eked out one in San Francisco to keep the division lead. It was a big win for them, but I don't think it should have happened. That last drive, the San Francisco defense just sat back and let Aaron Rodgers deal and move up the field and get in position for, like you said earlier, than we were talking, that everybody knew was going to happen. And it's, you know, he looked fallible before that. The defense played well and held him in check, and Garoppolo actually moved the team down, got him in position. Wish they, you know, hadn't scored so quickly because of that. But damn, they should have taken down the Packers, and the Vikings should be tied for first place.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you look at what Garoppolo did. I mean, my goodness, talk about the pressure that guy's under to keep his job, and you know, is beating Aaron Rodgers. Prime time, goes down the field, and his only thing that he did wrong was he threw a great pass that put the guy in the end zone too soon. and Aaron Rodgers, you could just see it in his eyes. You could see it in Mason Crosby's eyes. Here's what we're going to do. We're gonna complete two passes. We're going to kick the field goal, and that's what they do. But you're seeing a lot of that. I mean, now we're up to – in 3 weeks, we've had 10 games decided on a last-second field goal – or overtime. You know, 9 of them are makes, and your Vikings had the one deciding that got decided with by a miss. So it's every week. It's Atlanta kicks a 40-yard field goal at the buzzer. We saw the 66-yarder from Baltimore. Not only 66 yards, but it hits the crossbar and kind of slow motion goes over the crossbar. Daniel Carlson, as we all knew who that is. Kicks in overtime. They kicked two in overtime, which, you know, he got released in after he missed two against the Packers in overtime, I believe.
That's correct.
Three total. Yep. So you're just seeing it every week.
There's more emphasis on the kicking game, right? I mean, you know, it seems an afterthought with this head coach here in town at times, you know, because – total frustration, get rid of somebody, we'll get somebody else. We got this guy, you know, living on a week-to-week thread, but, you know.
Yeah, I Carlson, I mean, I had the same feeling. I think a lot of us had that same feeling that this guy is done in here. I mean, it was so strange for it to be so early. Now, he's never going to succeed. You know, maybe that's too knee-jerk. But what I also like is talking about just, you know what's going to happen. Like, you know Aaron Rodgers is going to come down and score. One thing I like about Brandon Staley, a rookie coach for the Chargers, what he did, it's 4th and 4. It is at the 30-yard line or whatever. He passes up in the closing minute. He passes up a 48-yard field goal to go for it against the Chiefs because he knows what's going to happen if he kicks a field goal. And all Mahomes needs to do is a field goal. So they false start. And he just says, I'm still going to go for it. 4th and 9, he goes for it, gets the first down. They score a touchdown. And they missed an extra point, but they beat the Chiefs by 6 points. These are the kind of decisions that have to be made based on who you're. It's not, to me, it's not all just analytics, like just taking all these numbers and putting them together without any faces to them. When you're playing Patrick Mahomes, you got to do that. When you're playing Aaron Rodgers, you got to do that when it's the situation calls for it. It's just, you've got to be aggressive and not leave it up to the kickers.
I saw just before we got on, started talking, a power rankings come down. I'm not a huge power rankings guy. I always like to see where the Vikings are and see who's doing well and who's up top. And the Packers are the fourth best team in the league, of course, according to this one. Do you think that's accurate?
Yeah, I didn't like them either, and I did them for years. We finally got away from that, thank God.
I used to read yours every year.
Yeah. It's just like moving puzzles around the board, you know. You just who knows, but yeah, we do the top two, the bottom two, and then where are the Vikings? So I got to still kind of read where the Vikings were. I put them at 18. I put them ahead of the 5-0-2s or 0-3s, and then all of the 1-2s except for the Chiefs, which I would still take the Chiefs over the Vikings.
Interesting. I don't like seeing the Packers in fourth, but hopefully when the Vikings get their chance to play them, they show them what they got. So, the Mighty Bucks went down. Stafford and the Rams, they were, you know, I wrote this to you before I saw it, but they were, are they the best team in the NFL? And that's what this power ranking put them at. They look really good right now.
Yeah.
This guy's got a new lease on life and a couple good receivers. They're a tough team.
Well, I mean, I would still take what Detroit got for him because Detroit's not going to win the Super Bowl with Stafford.
Right.
They're starting over yet again. So I would take those draft picks in a heartbeat for Stafford at his age. But through 3 weeks, it's exactly what Sean McVay and the Rams said that they needed to take the next step. Now they got a long way to go, and Stafford's got to stay healthy and all this. But so far, I mean, he's playing lights out. He's playing exactly the way that they want him to play. He's on the same page with Cooper Kupp, like they've been together for 10 years. The defense is the best defense in football last year, and Aaron Donald against Tom Brady. I mean, the answer to Tom Brady might be Aaron Donald, because that pressure up the middle changes who Brady is. It changes his rhythm. There's not too many people that can change that rhythm of what he can do, and the Rams found a way to do it. I think the Rams are the best team in football right now. I'd probably, the Bucks are up there, Raiders. I like the Raiders. And obviously, Packers are right there.
Yeah, unfortunately. You sent me a note about the rookie QBs. You've been kind of tracking them for us the past few weeks. What do you got on them for us this week?
Well, yeah, I mean, rookies are still rookies. I mean, we all want to see rookies play. We all, some of them are magical. I mean, Peyton Manning, his first year, set the record for rookie interceptions with 28. Well, right now, Trevor Lawrence and Zach Wilson have 7 interceptions, which puts them on a pace for 39 or 40 with a 17th game. So great. They're going to be good players. I think Lawrence is going to be a good player. Wilson, I don't know. I mean, he looks really, really confused. But yeah, all 5 of those guys started, or 5, there were 5 rookies that started. Davis Mills started for the Houston on Thursday. They went 0-5, 7 interceptions, 2 pick sixes. Rookie starters, quarterback this year are 1-10. And the only reason they got the win is because Mac Jones beat Zach Wilson head to head. So, they're going to be, most of them are going to be good players. But if you're going to start rookies, this is what, I like when they start this many rookies because it makes the survivor pool picks a lot easier. It's like you find who the Jets are playing and you take the other team, and it's whether they're on the road or not. So, and he also looking around the NFL, Teddy Bridgewater, 3-0, Broncos are 3-0. Now that granted, the 3 teams they beat are 0-9, and they play the Ravens this week. So we'll see a little bit more about, the Teddy magic out there, but Teddy's looked really good, and the Broncos are looking good.
I saw a tweet that said the Vikings won this game on Sunday, and not one of their rookies played, and so they were then therefore calling the draft, the 2021 draft, a bust. A little premature, I think, on that. Yeah. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, the kick returner as a rookie, he played.
That's true.
I off the top of my head, I don't, but yeah, I mean, you're seeing around the league, you're seeing the Packers with that corner playing extremely well. Denver with its cornerback, ninth overall pick, that they took a lot of heat for by not taking Fields or Mac Jones. So they're 3-0 with Teddy, who they gave up a sixth round pick for. Again, granted, all this is all early, but you talk about a move, getting Teddy for a sixth round pick and being one of those teams that changed quarterbacks, and that's all it took you to get your new quarterback. That's paying off pretty well so far. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's way too early to be saying it's a bust, because Darisaw as a left tackle, if he's what they thought he was or think he is, you know, this is, you won't even remember it in when he's, you know, an established starter. Right. Starting to look less likely, like it'll be anytime soon, but even though he's practicing, if they keep the offensive line, keeps playing the way it is, he's not going to see the field. They'd be stupid to like put, just because he's a first round draft pick and they're rolling on the offensive line to put him in. You just don't do that just so you can say, hey, we used our draft pick.
Right. And Zim doesn't like playing rookies anyway. He likes to, you know, Spurs certainly at cornerbacks and such, he likes to season them a little bit before he, unless he has to
play them. Well, yeah, like last year. I mean, even he admitted they whiffed on that, on thinking that they could let all that experience go at corner and then fill it with all rookies. Especially when they lost Daniil in the pass rush, it was the perfect storm. I mean, you had no pass rush and you had rookies at corner and no fans in the stands. So it was a nightmare for them.
One last question for you, Mark. I've kind of tuned in the last couple weeks and really enjoyed it on Monday Night Football, watching the Mannings on Monday Night Football. I don't know if you've seen it at all.
I have not seen it, yeah.
It's worthwhile tuning in. I haven't sat there the whole time because I keep forgetting that it's on. But it's fun. They have some great guests. I mean, they had Charles Barkley on there. They had last night. They had Nick Saban and one of the Long brothers. They had just friends of theirs that come on, and it's insightful, you know, to watch it, because you got these two guys who really know the quarterback position and they can really tell you what they're seeing coming from the offenses on the field. So I think it's worthwhile, and it's starting to, you know, pick up steam. Whereas, you know, they're not coming back for about until week 7 or 8, I think. It's, you know, for the Rube sitting on his couch, it's funny too. I mean, last night, Eli Manning flipped off the crowd, showing, you know, whoever was watching, because he was demonstrating what happens when he used to go to Philadelphia. You know, that he goes, I got flipped off double birds by a 9-year-old kid. So he had to apologize.
That's Philly.
Pardon? Yeah, that is. He had to
apologize. That is Philly.
So I don't know. It's worth tuning in if you get a chance at, you know, just to hear two quarterbacks and whoever else talk about it. So I thought I'd bring that up.
Philly is the only stadium where the fans will turn and pound on the windows where the media is sitting and flip you off and you know, taunt you. And it's like, hey, buddy, I'm covering the team. I don't care who wins or loses. You know, so it gets going back to the vet when there was covered a game there in the open press box where there's no, you know, there's no window in front of you. It's that's a rough place for. Let's put it this way. If I'm a Vikings fan or not a fan of another team, I go and I cheer for my team, but I don't bother. I wouldn't put a jersey on it. Like I say, if you're over 18 years old, you shouldn't wear a jersey. But I would not go strutting into Philly with the opponent's jersey on. It's not worth it.
Hell, the Philly fans even went after Millie, that Vikings fan, when they took him on in the NFC Championship. But
anyway. Well, they're punching horses and everything out there. So you got to be, if you're punching horses out there, it's hardcore.
Yes, it is. Well, on that note, we'll say so long for this week. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks to the sponsors. Thanks for everybody that helps out. Mike in the background, Mark on here, and we appreciate you listening, downloading, watching. Well, watching not so much. Who wants to see us? But that's okay. We'll be back next week with a post Cleveland Vikings game, and Mark will probably be either really, I don't know how Mark will respond. He's a professional journalist. He doesn't care who wins. He just said it on record there. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, you're rooting for the uniforms. That's what it is. It's
that's right.
The uniform of your childhood.
Well, thanks again.
About it.
And we'll see you next week with that wrap up. And as always, for Joe, skull.